Yeah. Okay.
Be what it is.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Health Committee. It is March 18th, 2015, and I'm going to do a little bit of jumping around here. I'm going to, first of all, let people know about Senate Bill 673. As you know, we requested the Board of Dentistry to give some input. And so they really did, and by letter. And it's too bad that they didn't weren't here to testify. So I don't really think that this is prime time yet. I haven't talked with the sponsor of the bill, of which I am one.
You mean you aren't talking to yourself?
But I need to talk. There are a number of issues that I'll have Zena post on OLIS. It is posted on OLIS, and we are going to need to address some of those issues before we can pass this bill out. So 673, if you are here for 673 and you're very concerned that we're taking it off the agenda, you can come and talk to me later. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 336. Zena.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 336 appropriates $900,000 out of the general fund to the Oregon Health Authority to establish parity for school-based health centers. There is a -2 amendment which requires additional funding for school-based health centers. It adds $52,000 in parity funding, $900,000 for planning administration, $97,000 for technical assistance. The fiscal and revenue statements have been issued. There is no revenue impact. And fiscal impact.
Yeah. And this bill is combining 338 into this bill. So
are we ready?
We're ready.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendment to Senate Bill 336.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendments to 336. It's dated 3/5/15, the amendment. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 336 as amended by the -2 amendment to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee of on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay, so Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 336 as amended with the -2s with a due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries, and who's the sponsor of this bill? Oh, me.
Well, you ain't alone there.
I know.
That
shows you where my head's at today. Okay. It's up to you or me.
No, it's going to Ways and Means, so we don't assign right. a carrier.
Yeah, I'll watch on it.
Thank you.
Ways and Means.
All right.
It'll come to our
it's on its way. I close the work session on.
We could be assigned to it in Ways and
that's
Means
right.
as co-carriers. If
I will close the work session.
I said I'd keep an eye out for you, Senator.
On Senate Bill 336. All right. We've closed it. All right. Now, I forgot that Senator Bates was here, and so let us open a public hearing on 594. Come on up, Doc.
Senate Bill 594 specifies that healthcare practitioners are not required to submit credentialing information to the Oregon Health Authority until the Oregon Health Authority has established an operational electronic system. It alters the date for the Oregon Health Authority to report on implementation of the electronic system to the interim committees of the Legislative Assembly. There's no amendment, and fiscal and revenue statements have been issued. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, I'm a state senator, District 3. And a family practitioner. Committee members, thank you for considering this bill. The problem is that we're trying to deal with, at least, is credentialing. And credentialing is a process that healthcare providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, nurses, and others go through to get credentialed at various hospitals. They have to get credentialed with various insurance companies. My credentialing process, as an example, has about 50 different players I have to get credentialed with just to practice. A lot of that's done through my IPA or my physician group that does it for me. But it's very complex, has to be updated on a regular basis to make sure that I've not had something negative happen in my practice that they want to know about and rightfully should know about. Problem is, getting that done every year is really tough. I used to be chief of medicine at two large hospitals, and we'd go through all our 400 and 500 doctors every year, send them out forms, they'd fill them out, send them back exactly the same every year, and then I'd send the same forms to them for the other hospital, which was just exactly the same. They had to fill it out, sign it, and get it all back to us. What we're trying to do is set up an electronic database where we have a central place for the basic information we need. Hospitals and other plans can ask for more information, but that information that is most needful for them would be in a central and secure place to do it from. They could draw from on a regular basis. It would be updated on a regular basis, and it would save tremendous amount of money and time for everybody involved. The bill was passed last year, and it went through with a good vote on both sides of the House and the Senate. The problem we're dealing with right now is actually extending the time for activating it, and we're extending that time for the most part because we have to make sure we get the IT part of it right. This has been a problem for 30 years. There's no rush to get this done. Let's get it done right. Now, I know the state has a wonderful record for getting IT right with no problems.
We're doing a lot, actually.
We've never
actually,
had an issue
really
like
well.
This before. But I would say that in this particular case, just saying, we want to take a little extra time, make that IT portion of it work right, make sure it's secure, the right information is there, that it flows back and forth the way it's supposed to. And so for the most part, what this bill does is says we're moving the date for activation of the program until we actually get this done the correct way, and I'm perfectly okay with that. This is not an agency pulling back and not getting the job done. They're being abundantly cautious, which I think is appropriate.
Do you think it'll happen in our lifetime?
What I hope won't happen, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, what I'm hoping won't happen in our lifetime is another failure of an IT project involved in health care. That's what I don't want in my lifetime. I believe they're probably a year to year and a half away of really getting it right, and I'm willing and more than willing to take that time to get it done right.
Yeah.
Senator Steiner-Harry.
Just really quick, and maybe you don't know the answer to the senator, but there's no commercial system, off-the-shelf system that any other state is using already?
There are several off-the-shelf systems that are available. They're not, as far as I know, statewide and for this larger group. And they're looking at those systems, and there's some discussion going on which one's the best one that would work us. And we have special, because our insurance situations are different, and there's some insurance companies that are multi-state and some that aren't.
Right.
There's lots of complications here. We want to make sure we get it right. There are some off-the-shelf things that they're looking at. They're not writing this de novo. This is something they're going to take what's available and bring it in and make it work right. So that's my understanding of it.
Yeah, that's, if I may, Madam Chair, that's much better because when we do that, then we end up with a much better situation. That's what the Department of Revenue is doing now with a really, really huge project, and it's going smooth as silk. So on time, under budget.
Yep. And Madam Chair, as you know, the prescription management bill was done that way. No trouble, works great. We made a few tweaks to it to make it a little bit better since it was done, but it came online perfectly and worked the way we wanted it to. So if you take your time and do these right, you can make them work. Okay.
Would you like Bill Gates' phone number? I mean,
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, if you got the number, I'll make the call.
Do you know if there's any opposition?
There has been opposition from different groups, mainly concerned about having to, they have their own system for credentialing people, and so they've needed time to change to a new system. They've invested in those systems. And Kaiser and others, as an example, have for long, many years done this a certain way. For them to switch to a system that everyone can use, there's some difficulty there for them. I think we have to recognize that and work with them on it. Now, I think we got most of that worked out on the last session, and the new system we're putting together, if it's done properly, should actually, in the end, save them money. We think this thing is going to save hundreds of millions of dollars once it's up and running properly. But you've got a takedown system you got and build into a new system, so we have to give people time to do that.
Okay. Great, because no one has signed up in opposition to the bill, and so we're going to hear the from Susan Otter and Eric Doolin. But with that, any other comments? Thank you.
I'm trying to think of how I could bug Doc more, but maybe I'll let it go for now.
You'll, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, you'll have other opportunities.
We will, yes.
Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, thank you, Senator Bates. Okay, Susan Otter and Eric Doolin.
Senator Montes-Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Susan Otter, and I'm the Director of Health Information Technology for the Oregon Health Authority. We are the office that is responsible for working with our IT shop and DAS to implement the common credentialing solution. I'm here today to present testimony on Senate Bill 594. So I think Senator Bates did a great job of going over what credentialing is and what the bill does. I'd just like to add a few things. I have testimony, written testimony for the record. As Senator Bates mentioned, we know that there are about 24 vendors that are operating today that have off-the-shelf solutions out there. We did an RFI as required by the Senate Bill 604 earlier in last year, and we've received some great responses to that that have really helped inform our next steps. We've also established, as required, the Common Credentialing Advisory Group that meets regularly to oversee the project and work with the state staff on requirements, on rules, and also on that RFI that we did earlier last year. The Senate Bill 594, as Senator Bates mentioned, removes the date requirement. It replaces it with a notice that OHA is required to send a notice by rule to stakeholders of what the actual implementation will be, so that folks have that time, know ahead of time, and have time to prepare for when the system will be operational. It also requires OHA to report to the legislature on or before February 1st, 2016, as well on the progress. So with that, I think I'll keep my comments very brief. Flexibility in the implementation date will ensure that we have a sufficient amount of time to implement the system properly, methodically, and that it has the value that we all know and that it has the promise to have. Thank you.
Questions?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, and members of the Health Committee. My name is Eric Doolin. I'm the Senior Vice President of Operations and Chief Information Officer at Pacific Source. I'm also the co-chair of the Common Credentialing Advisory Committee that Susan referenced. Our committee is in support of Senate Bill 594. We have been working with OHA very closely since passage of that legislation and really providing a lot of our thoughts about requirements and implementation strategies. The advisory group is made up of a broad range of constituents, including health plans, hospitals, providers, members from the representatives from the licensing boards, just a whole broad range of all the stakeholders that are involved in this. And so we've gotten a nice set of input through that process. We've made a lot of progress over the last year, but really want to make sure that we've got the time to implement this successfully, as Senator Bates mentioned, is critically important to this effort. So we're definitely supportive of this change and are looking forward to getting this implemented. It will have a huge savings for everybody that participates in this process. So anxious to get it going. Would appreciate your support of this legislation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? All right. Thank you very much. No one else has signed up? Anybody? Last call. All right. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 594 and open a work session on Senate Bill 594.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 594 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, this is moving us into the 21st century. It's a good move.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Hayward?
Aye.
Senator
Cope? Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Bates, please carry it. Yes, I'm going to carry it. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 594 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 684. Zena.
allows the Oregon Medical Board to issue limited licenses to practice medicine to physicians licensed in another state or country who hold full-time professor appointment at a school of medicine in Oregon. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Great. And I have, is it Sanjeev Kaul?
Yes.
So we're going to listen to it, right? Mm-hmm. Good.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Anderson and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 684. For the record, my name is Sanjeev Kaul. I am the CEO of the Knight Cardiovascular Institute and the Associate Dean of Medicine at OHSU. Senate Bill 684 permits the Oregon Medical Board to issue a limited license to practice medicine to a physician licensed in another state or country, provided that person holds a professor appointment at a school of medicine in this state. This bill is important to help address a situation that is putting OHSU at a disadvantage in recruiting potential high-quality faculty members from elsewhere. OHSU is working hard to build a world-class academic health center to improve the health and well-being of Oregonians. This means recruiting highly skilled and highly qualified faculty members from leading academic institutions in the U.S. and around the world. In the case of highly distinguished medical practitioners and physician scientists from overseas who have tremendous experience and expertise but do not, in some cases, have a U.S. medical degree, OHSU is at a significant disadvantage relative to other health centers and universities around the country. This is because Oregon requires all practitioners to take the three-step United States medical licensing exam that is typically given to students in the U.S. during and after graduating from medical school. This test is not an appropriate gauge of the skill of highly qualified provider and faculty members who have been practicing for 20 years or more. Because Oregon requires these highly qualified and sought after individuals to take this examination in order to be considered for licensure in this state, these individuals are dissuaded for even considering OHSU. Oregon is right to expect a lot from its licensed physicians and should analyze their skills and experience rigorously. The Oregon Medical Board should be able to use their experience and judgment to do this analysis in a limited number of cases where the individuals are highly distinguished with significant skills and experience. Senate Bill 684 gives the Oregon Medical Board the discretion to evaluate international medical practitioners on their merits rather than simply requiring such individuals to take a test aimed at medical students. We have worked with the Oregon Medical Board in drafting this legislation, and they are ready to implement this license. I ask that you support this bill, which will help OHSU and other medical universities in Oregon to recruit the best practitioners and physician scientists from around the world in order to serve Oregonians. Thank you for your time. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Medical board, please. Okay. I hear that they're good.
Yeah.
All right.
No.
I'll close the. Thank you very much, Dr. Kaul. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 684 and open the work session on Senate Bill 684.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 684 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 684 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Joe?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chairman Walsh?
Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Devlin will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 684 and open a public hearing. Public hearing on Senate Bill 698. Zena.
Senate Bill 698 creates the School Nursing Consultant in the Oregon Health Authority. It establishes a 14-member task force on school nursing. It directs the task force to examine funding sources for school nurses and make recommendations. It repeals the task force in December 2016. There's a -1 amendment, and there is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Thank you. Now, was a dash 2 posted on OLIS or not?
Yes, Madam Chair, but I don't think.
Yeah. So for those of you that are looking at the dash 2, they are gone for right now because it did what we didn't. It does what we don't want it to do. And so we are going to not consider the dash 2s, but we'll have people speaking to it. So who do we start with?
Jen Baker.
Okay, yeah. Jen Baker, Nina Fakaris, and Margot Lilick.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I'll be very brief because this is a follow-up to a public hearing that was held last month about school nursing services. Senate Bill 698 does a very similar to the last bill you heard, creates a task force to look at funding for school nurse services and puts a one full-time position in the Oregon Health Authority to be a school nurse consultant and liaison with the Department of Education to figure out how we can begin to transition the school nursing services that are provided away from the Department of Education and into the Oregon Health Authority. And this is, again, aimed at, just as a reminder, helping the legislature meet the goal that they set of having one school nurse for every 750 students by 2020.
Thank you very much, Jen.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. Once again, as the Director of Schoolhouse Services for MESD, which is Multnomah Educational Service District, I'm asking for your support of Senate Bill 698.
And your name.
I'm sorry about that, Margot Lalich. Apologize. During the past year, I've had many conversations with stakeholders and community partners about my concerns related to the delivery of nursing services in the school setting. I also provided testimony on February 23, 2015. While school nurses in the school setting respond to the whole child, their interventions are primarily health-related. Yet education continues to assume fiscal responsibility for this care, care that is billable outside of the school setting. During the spring of 2014, MESD Schoolhouse Services surveyed small, medium, and large-sized school districts to gather data on how much was being spent on school nursing. Approximately $23 to $25 million of the education budget are being spent on nursing services in the school. This morning, I attended a meeting of new MESD nurses for the school year. They spent 2 hours sharing stories reflecting on the significant yet unknown impact they make every day as autonomous and partner providers of healthcare in schools. Healthcare that keeps students safe and in school every day. This morning, a nurse shared the story of a middle school student who was attending school while exhibiting the early signs of sepsis due to dental problems. This student had been in so much pain and discomfort that he had tried to pull his own teeth and was chronically using paper clips to dig at his teeth. There was not a school-based health center at this school. It was the school nurse and the school counselor who gained the necessary consents and coordinated the community resources to get the student the appropriate dental care. This is a student who was not able to achieve their educational potential at that time and who would have ended up in an emergency room and potentially hospitalized for sepsis, a very costly and life-threatening illness. This is one story, yet I had a list of them after 2 hours. These are school nurses who are responsible for thousands of students and multiple schools every day providing health care. Yet, you would not know this because there's no infrastructure in place to capture this information or account for the investment, $23 to $25 million.
Margo, since we have already heard your testimony from before and you were so compelling, it's really not necessary for you to go into as much depth as you are.
I would like to speak to the nurse consultant position, Chair Mona Sanderson.
Thank you.
A school nurse consultant position at the Oregon Health Authority within the School and Adolescent Health Program and at ODE makes sense. The Oregon Health Authority School-Based Health Center Program appropriately describes school nurses and school-based health centers as partners in providing comprehensive health services. Your support of Senate Bill 698 will begin to balance the resources, gather comprehensive data, create an integrated infrastructure for the delivery of school health services, and provide expertise that will inform the most effective strategy for the provision of comprehensive health services and meet the needs of all students, including the most medically complex. And I bring up the medically complex because today, literally today, we have students who are entitled to free and appropriate public education but are not able to attend school because we do not have enough qualified school nurses.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And again, you've already testified, and we don't really need a repeat of what you said before.
Absolutely, Chair Mona Sanderson, committee, thank you very much. Nina Fakaris, school nurse, Beaverton School District. I'm here simply as an expert to provide answers to any questions you might have regarding the Dash 1 amendments to this legislation. It's simply better defines a member of the task force, and it better defines what we're looking for as far as school funding streams using healthcare dollars and taking it out of education dollars. But I'm just simply here to answer any questions that you might have regarding the bill or that amendment.
So the only question I have is, this is on the Dash 1s, you're deleting 18 lines 18 and 19, providing clinical, let's see, that's page two, just a minute. One member who represents, you're deleting one member who represents a labor organization representing nurses in the state and who is a classified school employee working directly with school nurses to provide care to students, and putting in one member who represents a labor organization that represents classified school employees who work directly with school nurses. Can you explain exactly why that was done?
Chair Mona Sanderson, that was done to ensure that an employee who works as a classified employee at a school district is able to participate in this task force. At this point in time, many of those folks are being asked to provide services to students who need medical services in lieu of a presence of a school nurse. So we're hoping to have their perspective and input in the task force as well.
I think it's a really good idea.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
And then you're deleting lines 28 and to 30 on the same page and replacing it. And please explain why that was done.
I believe the original language talked about establishing kind of more balanced funding streams, looking at education dollars and healthcare dollars. And it's being replaced with language that says that we just want to, at this point, look at healthcare dollars, looking at insurances and those kinds of things as a way to try to look at new funding streams for school nurses.
Excellent.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
This is a very good amendment.
All right. Yeah. Thank you so much. And thank you.
Thank you.
All right. But don't go away, you know. You can go sit down, but
sit down,
in case we need to pull you back. Yeah. Okay, Cynthia Bakey, Laurel Mertz, and Lori Wimmer.
This is going exactly where we want it to.
Yes, absolutely.
So.
Yeah,
it's
really good.
I'll put some stuff on the record before we pass it down. So.
Yes.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll start first because I have the least to say.
Okay.
committee members, for your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 42,000 members, two of whom are with me today. I served on the Regional Education Task Force with Senator Cruz and a few other people, and we had a lot. We learned a lot about this issue and are very happy to support this bill, which aligns perfectly with what it was that we learned and thought that as a task force ought to be done going forward. So with that, I'm here only in advisory capacity. If you have any questions, I'm going to turn it over to my members.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair Anderson and committee members. My name is Cynthia Bakey. Thank you for allowing me a few minutes to inform you as to why the passage of Senate Bill 698 is so important to all school-age citizens of our state. I am a registered nurse holding my bachelor's degree from Linfield College.
I worked at Emmanuel Pediatrics for 12 years. You can see school nursing is very dear to my heart. I worked at Emmanuel Pediatrics for 12 years and have been a school nurse for the last 4 years. I'm a lifelong Oregonian who strives to see our future leaders get the best that they can. By having a state school nursing consultant under the Oregon Health Authority, our state can be better prepared to serve our school children. I believe this can happen through coordination of services and forward thinking. A few months ago, I sat in on a school nurse training for emergency preparedness. I personally have worked in 4 different school districts, and each school district goes about preparing for emergencies in a totally different manner. What I discovered during this training was that the other districts do their training even differently than the 4 districts that I've worked in. The vocabulary is different, the structure is different, and the methods of training are different, not to mention the level of seriousness it does or does not carry. There seems to be no standard. A statewide school nurse consultant could change this so that all districts are on the same page. If an emergency strikes, the nearby districts would know what and how to interact. If the recent measles outbreak really took hold in our state, would there have been any coordination of services? How would the state have looked at things on the school level? Another example of coordinations of services that would benefit our students is having a lead for statewide school nurses is to express to other state agencies what we bring to the table, us nurses. School nurses are educated professionals with years of experience. For this reason, the school nurses' opinions should be taken for the seriousness that is usually meant. Last year, I had a very complex student who moved to my school in December. She was 17 years old and pregnant. Her developmental level was probably that of a 10 or 12-year-old. She was constantly getting lost in school and could only seem to find my office. Medically, she was all right. Socially, it was a complete mess. She had moved to my school from Idaho for a short time, 60 days at that school in Idaho. Before that, she was in California. The first report I made to DHS was due to the fact that she had not had any prenatal care, and mom had not gotten her enrolled in any OHP. She was 17, so the report was taken. She turned 18 just 2 months later when I discovered both her mom and stepdad had served time for child endangerment and neglect. The stepdad was still on parole. When I made this DHS report, the intake worker wasn't going to take a report because she was 18. Here I am, the school nurse, and wasn't being listened to when a student was in danger. Even now I tell this story again, I get pretty upset at how I had to push so hard to get this student into a safe living situation. The school nurse is not only trained in nursing, we usually have a pretty good gut instinct on when something isn't right. We have the experience coupled with the education. A state school nurse consultant would be able to educate other statewide agencies in this, and kids as a whole across the state would benefit. With a school nursing consultant, school nurses would be able to weigh in on issues that are in our near future. Currently, at one of the high schools that I serve, I care for a student that has a chronic illness. This student is in a life skills class, non-mobile, gets nourishment through a G-tube, which is a small tube attached to her stomach through her skin, and through that, she gets nourishment through a syringe. Unfortunately, she also has about 4 to 5 seizures a week, lasting anywhere from 4 to 13 minutes each time. At home, her parents give her Marinol, which is a synthetic prescribed medication, also used to treat nausea and increase appetite in cancer patients. For this student, it also decreases her seizures. Unfortunately, it cannot be given in the schools. It is not because it's a controlled substance. We allow students to take controlled substances for common behavior issues. This student cannot get this medication because it has a THC component. I can only imagine how this issue will be coming to the school nurse so much more in the near future. We school nurses need someone to look into this matter and direct all the schools in an appropriate policy that keeps everyone safe and gets children the care that they need. I thank you so much for your time, and I'm more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Laurel Murs. Thank you very much for hearing from me today. I'm a school nurse at Benson Polytechnic High School and Sabin School, which is a K-8 in North Portland. I went to nursing school at Wayne State University in Detroit, where we mostly focused on the care of that community, which is mostly older, chronically ill people. And I always had a passion for nursing young people. And so when I came home to Oregon, I got my first job as a nurse in a pediatric clinic in an ambulatory care center. and then thankfully got a position as a school nurse. What I love about this job already, just 6 months in, is that it's very autonomous, that it's very dynamic. I love that I get to be part of a community of people who all care very much about the students that I also care very much about, and that we work as a team to keep them safe at school and to keep them well enough to be at school and to provide a safe place for them when they're at school. I love that I get to be a case manager, that I get to be a student advocate, that I get to be a walk-in triage and first aid clinic. I love all of it. I love it so much. But what has been challenging is that I spend 4 days at Benson, the high school, where I've been able to, because I'm 4 days there, really grow my relationships with the other people who are giving care to these students, whether from counselors to the school psychologist or the special ed teachers. I don't have that same experience at Sabin, where I end up sort of being is the secretary's one day off from having to give out Band-Aids. And I think that that is because I don't have time to be there enough for those students. And I think that anything, including this bill, that can help us reach that goal of one nurse to 700 kids would be great. Right now, between the Benson, where I also have three other schools in residence, and Sabin School, I have upwards of 1,500, depending on the day, because some of those are coming in and out of Reconnections Academy. That seems like a lot. So I very much support this and hope that you'll get us there. And I always like to provide a little supportive evidence. So that's what nurses do, right? You come up with my assessment is we need more nurses in schools, and here's my as evidenced by. So here's an example. At Sabin School, where I am just 1 day a week, who knows what would have been like if I wasn't there or where the student would end up today, but I had a student sent to me by a teacher because he was missing a chunk of hair in his head. And so I checked this clump of missing hair, and it looked like his skin was intact. It was a little red. Didn't have any lice or anything that looked like it could have caused it. It didn't look flaky like you'd see in eczema, or it just looked like it'd been pulled. It even had like little flecks of blood, like as if it'd been sort of traumatically pulled out. And so I went through this same questions that any provider of healthcare would, like, well, when did this happen? When did you notice your hair was missing? He said he'd woken up with his hair missing, and that he didn't know where it went, and he didn't notice any on the pillow. He didn't see any blood on his pillow, and I was racking my brain to sort of figure out what would cause a person to pull out their own hair while they're, like, sleeping. So I said, you know, we do weird stuff when we're sleeping sometimes, particularly if we're stressed out about something. Can you think of anything that you're going through right now that would make you feel stressed out and that your subconscious might freak out about it while you're dreaming and make you pull out your hair? And he started to cry. And he said, I have an older brother, and he's been in and out a lot. He likes to run away. And it makes my parents really sad. And they're thinking about not being together anymore. And it makes me really sad. And now he's in this program where he might get to come home next weekend. And I'm excited and I'm scared because I think he'll just leave again. And I think, well, anyway. So we talked for a long time. And it was great. And, you know, what's interesting is then because I was there once a week, I got to sort of go out of my way to sort of run into him and say, how are things going? And where's your brother? And things aren't going well with the brother. But I was also able to coordinate with his mom and found out that he had a mentor through the Boys and Girls Club, and to make sure that he was also receiving some kind of sort of mental health support, that the family, I suggested that they look into getting some family counseling to work together as a family through it. And, you know, I saw this kiddo just yesterday. I was at the school on a Tuesday, which is very unusual, but they are having a run. And so I got to be there to see them do a run for the arts. And when I asked him how things were at home, he was all smiles. And so I just feel like that's proof that nurses are necessary and that we, you know, our goal is to care for a whole person, body, mind, and spirit. That's the definition of nursing. And so that's what we'd like to provide. And I think that it's much easier to do that when we have fewer students to try to provide it for. So thank you so much for hearing my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank you for that testimony. I represent SAFE in the Oregon Senate, and it's just very fulfilling to hear that they're getting such great care. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. They would love to have me more than one day a week. Ask the secretaries. They'll
loud and clear, yes.
Thank you very much, panel. And Vicki Chamberlain, I'd like you, we did have the dash twos, and there is an issue that we want to make sure that we address with another amendment, but you will be working with Jen Baker, I assume, and Lori Wimmer on
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. Since 1991, there have been statutes and TSPC statutes to certify school nurses. Today, there's fewer than 76 certified, about 55 of them are employed. And to get the certification, they also have to be licensed by the Board of Nursing. We're suggesting any work by the task force look at this duplicate certification, see if it's necessary, and see if there's a way to combine the efforts.
Great.
Can I just make a comment about that? I see absolutely no reason, with all due respect, and I think you're saying the same thing, that school nurses need to be certified by TSPC. I mean, it's just a nurse is a nurse is a nurse, and if they don't need to be certified to serve in a school-based health center, why would they need to be separately certified to be a school nurse? I mean, I don't have to be certified separately as a physician to work in different environments. I think it's important to have an understanding of the population you're serving, but I hope we're saying the same thing because it seems like overkill to me personally.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 698 and open a work session on Senate Bill 337. Zena.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 337 appropriates $1.4 million to the Oregon Health Authority for the biennium to establish 11 new school-based health centers. We have the paperwork. There's no revenue impact, and there's a fiscal impact.
Great.
Madam Chair. I move Senate Bill 337 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 337 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
All right, motion carries, and it's on the way. I close the work session on Senate Bill 337 and open a public hearing, Senate Bill 440. Zena.
Madam Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 440 creates the Health Plan Quality Metrics Committee to develop health outcome and quality measures for coordinated care organizations and plans offered by the Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board. It requires the committee to publish recommendations and requires consideration of health outcome and quality measures in contracting for health benefit plans. It eliminates the metrics scoring committee. There is a dash one amendment, and we do not have the paperwork.
Great. Felicia Hagen, Jessica Adamson, Jeremy Vandehagen.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins. I'm the political director for the Service Employees International Union, Local 49. We're here to discuss Senate Bill 440. We're in support of this legislation, and it's a concept that we've been working with Senator Steiner Hayward to bring forward. The problem is right now, currently in the state of Oregon,
there are at least five groups who are creating healthcare metrics for a variety of the health plans in the state, and more being added every day. Our hope with this bill, and there's been good work done actually on the coordinated care organizations metrics, and aligning those with the Public Employees Benefit Board. Our hope with this bill is that we're really trying to align a direction of where we're headed in the state when it comes to tracking quality metrics. And we think that this our goal with Senate Bill 440 will be to address issues related to those metrics being dispersed over a bunch of different programs and state agencies. We feel like that lack of alignment currently causes problems for providers. It also causes quite a bit of problems for payers, and as well as consumers, so that we can have clarity in the state of where we're going and what we're measuring. We really think that Senate Bill 440 and the -1 amendments, we're hoping that not only does it create that alignment, it creates a process that's clear for people to engage in what those metrics are going to be in the future. And finally, there are additions in the -1 amendments around the timeliness of the bill that are very important. In the -1 amendments, we moved the timeline for implementation because it needed to match the timelines related to the CMS waiver around CCOs and the other issues around other CMS waivers that we're currently either in process of or will be in process of shortly. And there's been additions about when the health authority needs to release new metrics to CCOs because there's been issues around not giving coordinated care organizations or providers an opportunity to update their medical record systems in time before the expectation is to be reported on those metrics. We do have some changes to the -1 amendments. We thought it was important to move forward with the hearing today to hear issues and feedback on the record, but we really want to make sure that we are taking a look at the board to make sure that the board is a manageable size, but expansive enough to represent the interests that need to be included to have a robust set of metrics. We need to make changes around the data reporting collection that is in the -1 amendment. The original bill had an outline for data and reporting that got replaced by this committee actually taking over the All Payer All Claims database. That is not our intention at all. We do not want that to happen. And there are some issues around additional language and timelines that we need to clear up. But our hope is to bring a group of stakeholders together next Monday to have these and other issues resolved. And I'm happy to take any questions.
Let's hear from the panel and then.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremy Vandehey with Kaiser Permanente. Thanks for the opportunity to testify today. And just following up on Felice's comments, there's more amendments coming, so I'm speaking more to the conceptual amendments that you will see, hopefully before the deadline for work session in this bill. But there's, it's really a simple bill, I think, conceptually. It's really two components. One, you'll see this in the -2s, the Oregon Health Policy, directing the Oregon Health Policy Board to come up with a strategic plan around how we collect and use data to support the goals of transformation and setting some real clear objectives around that, and then aligning the performance metrics. And I'll have Jessica talk about the latter in a second. The former is really important because if we're talking about performance metrics, we got to be talking about what data we're using to measure those things. And so that really strikes up a larger conversation about what are we collecting and how are we using it, and how is it tied to promoting the objectives in the state around transformation. And so what we'll be adding to this bill is a direction to the policy board, engage in a public process to engage stakeholders, to develop a strategic plan around some clear objectives around how healthcare data will be collected and used to drive the goals of transformation. And this isn't a criticism. We've been moving really fast with CCO development in the state. But as we start to move out into other markets, it's really important that we understand what their clear objectives are about what we want to achieve with healthcare data, ensure that we're using the correct type of data to promote those goals. And I'll give an example here. So we are collecting a lot of claims data in the state under the All Payer Claims Database. Claims data is very fee-for-service driven. So as we one of the clear goals of transformation is to promote payment reform. So we, as we have that goal in mind, we need to be thinking about how are we collecting data, how are we using it in a way that promotes payment reform, while we also have the opportunity to measure performance. And so we just, this will create an opportunity, a venue for us to have that discussion, create some really clear objectives, and align stakeholders across the state, whether it's payers, state programs, providers, around those clear objectives, so we're all moving in the right direction, not collecting data that's not going to be used, and likewise making sure that we are collecting the most appropriate data for the goals that we're trying to achieve. Once we have that strategic plan, I think the next piece is then how do we align those metrics across the markets, and I'll turn it over to Jessica for that piece.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services. It has been our pleasure to work really as a team this interim on this concept. It's very important as providers and payers. What we see today with the current metrics environment creates a lot of confusion on the ground in terms of implementation. As a provider, we don't look at the patient's insurer or payer and then change workflow based upon that. If we're going to implement a new metric, if we're going to implement a new screening tool as required by either the CCOs or OEB or PEB or pick a metric entity that establishes them, we are going to do it across the spectrum for all of our patients. And when there are different metrics with different desired outcomes, they're not aligned in one direction of trying to change healthcare, that creates a lot of confusion on the ground. It creates a significant challenge in terms of implementation. And again, not a criticism. There's been a lot of ramp up going on, but what we've seen to date are metrics that are coming online that aren't tested before they're an incentive measure. You've got over $100 million tied to CCO incentives. And on the ground, providers are trying to implement metrics that they don't have measurement and data for prior to implementation. We've had changes in measurement halfway through the measurement year. That's creating significant confusion and difficulty for providers and patients, and we aren't developing the outcomes that we're really looking for. Senate Bill 440, by aligning those metrics, by ensuring that regardless of the payer type, we're going to be pulling from a menu of metrics that are all developed with clinician voices at the table to make sure they are implementable, they're built off of national benchmark data, they're going to be around for a while, that we're really focused on how do we do those well. We're going to be able to implement those better. We're going to be able to drive better outcomes and quality. We're going to do it in a way that's focused. By moving this group underneath the Oregon Health Policy Board, we enable the board to really set a strategic direction on where we should focus on developing additional quality metrics. That feeds down to this group that is broader, more robust, has a wide variety of voices that'll then be able to develop a menu of, if you're going to do a set of metrics, you need to choose from these that are all developed and measured in a way that is doable and thoughtful. We absolutely support innovation and pushing the envelope on how do we move forward with metrics that will push us to do better healthcare in the state. But we need to do that in a way that's thoughtful and has everyone's voice at the table. Senate Bill 440 accomplishes that. It needs amendments. It needs additional work. We look forward to being a part of that process and engaging the whole healthcare community in that discussion. But we believe that this is, frankly, one of the most important pieces of legislation that could pass this session and really help move the ball forward on improving quality, improving data, improving healthcare across the spectrum.
The one concern that I've heard, and I don't even remember who it was from, that there is such a difference, that there needs to be, and you need to tell me because I'm not a guru on this at all, there needs to be a metrics, the metrics for the CCO population is different from PEB and OEB. Yeah. And so will you please bring me on board on where you see this?
Yeah, Chair Mona Sanderson,
SEIU actually has worked aggressively over the last year in the PEB RFP process, which I'm sure you heard about, some of you have probably gotten mail about as being PEB members, to actually align the PEB metrics, the Public Employee Benefit Board metrics, with the CCO metrics, because we do feel like those metrics have actually been vetted. Now, there are some metrics that may not be entirely applicable to the PEB population. For the example, the screening of foster children was one of the questions that we had when we began the process. Turns out public employees, who are especially quite a few of them are child advocates, have a lot of foster kids, and so it was completely applicable to the PEB population. And what we found is those differences haven't shaken out when it comes to the alignment there. This bill doesn't do anything to determine the metrics. Actually, all it does is set a process for coming up with them. We felt like it was very important not to enshrine metrics in statute. We think that that leads us down a dangerous path, especially given that our hope is that evidence will change on how you treat people and how you measure things, especially related to Jeremy's comments around moving away from claims-based data. So.
Thanks. Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I mean, what we're going to accomplish here is what I was hoped to accomplish, and that's getting some deeper input from the folks with boots on the ground. And that's what needs to happen to make this real, I think, is so those on the ground really have whenever we've had the metrics explained to us in committee, it had just confused the heck out of me. And I'm not a healthcare professional, but by having the people who are actually delivering the services having input into what it is that needs to be measured and how, I think is going to give us a much better product.
Senator Steiner Hayward.
Yeah, and I would just add that if you're confused, Senator Cruz, in here, imagine how physicians or nurse practitioners or others in practice are when they have different metrics. I mean, some of you may remember from the 2013 session. When Senator Bates was working on his go-home bill as opposed to his take-home bill because his wife said he couldn't come back until there was one unified prior authorization form. It's the same issue here, right? Physicians, I mean, when a patient walks into a physician's office, the last thing that most physicians look at is what their insurance status is, right? They walk in and physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, whoever's seeing them on the front line should and usually does treat them exactly the same regardless of their insurance status. And that's as it should be, because we should not differentiate in care whether somebody's insured by PEB or OWEB or OHP. And all humans, I mean, the evidence is the evidence is the evidence about best care. Aligning these metrics means that actually we'll get to the point where even before I was a legislator, I sat in front of the Oregon Health Policy Board on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians saying I looked forward to the day when all of us would be in CCO-type environments because they would be getting better care. And I think overall people do get better care through CCOs in a lot of ways. So I think this is very exciting, and I'm honored to be working with you all on this.
It's okay, you're right.
Great.
So get us the amendments.
Okay. From your mouth to God's ears.
Jody Daniels, Jesse O'Brien, and B.J. Kavner.
Madam Chair, I'm Jody Daniels with GlaxoSmithKline. And I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 440. Let me make very clear up front, GlaxoSmithKline does not invent or create metrics. We don't have a metrics dog in this fight. However, we have been working with a number of states who have embarked on exactly this effort, trying to come up with a common set of healthcare outcome standards that they can begin to measure quality with their Medicaid programs, their PEB programs, and also their exchange programs. And the most recent effort was in Washington State, where we've worked real closely with Governor Inslee's office. And the Washington State Legislature just passed a bill very similar to this. They created what they call the Performance Measures Coordinating Committee. And that committee just came up with its first set of statewide measures. And in my testimony, I've got a link to their website. It's a very good body of work. It's really good work. And I thought I'd give you just a couple of insights from that process that I think made that process work really well. And the first is that the committee was a very diverse committee. It was not just your usual suspects. It included large and small businesses. There were patient advocacy groups, public health departments, both urban and rural, because they have very different perspectives, hospitals, providers, insurers, state staff, and experts. And I think what they brought to the table and the result of that is that you have a set of measures that have some very transformational measures, both in healthcare delivery, but also in population health. So I would really urge you to take a look at the makeup of the committee and make sure that it's diverse. The second thing is it was a very public process. I think it was surprising to everyone how much interest there was in this process. All of the committee meetings were open. All of the work group meetings were open. There was a lot of give and take. There was a lot of public comment. And let me just give you one example of the result of that is initially one of the committees just laid on the table in the area of diabetes says, well, let's measure for diabetes patients the number of times that they have their A1C levels measured, which is a common measure. And the American Diabetes Association came in and said, that's a good measure, but what you really want to know is not whether they're being tested, but whether or not they have their A1C level under control. So how about this control measure? And in the end, the committee adopted that measure. Same thing happened with immunizations. They initially weren't going to do any immunization measures because they thought the data was hard to get and not reliable. And the public health folks came pretty much unglued and said, you got to have some immunization measures. So again, the public process sometimes is messy. It takes a little bit longer. But in the end, I think the set was much more robust because of it. And finally, the other thing I would just highlight is that the most difficult issue that this committee faced was this whole issue of what is an outcome measure. There are a number, we have thousands of process measures like the diabetes measurement. And those are easy to get. You can get that from claims data. It's easy to collect. It's easy to report. What's a little more difficult is an outcome measure because it requires claims data, but it also requires you to look into either the electronic health records or a patient's chart. And providers are at different stages of reporting that. Some can do it easily, some cannot. But it is the outcome measures that are the truly transformational measures. So I would also, as a committee, basically let folks know that what your intention is the transformational measures moving towards the outcome measures, because that's what will bring us forward. The last thing I will say is that I, too, agree. I think I testified before the Oregon Health Policy Committee. I called this the sleeper bill because it doesn't have a whole lot of controversy about it, but I think that this bill will have a tremendous impact in moving us from pay for procedures to pay for performance. And I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is B.J. Kavanaugh. I'm with 1 in 4 Chronic Health. I'm here today to offer my support for Senate Bill 440. There is some more information outlined in my written testimony. I'll just state briefly that Oregon currently does measure reporting areas in, around grievance statistics, utilization, quality assessment, and scope of network summaries. If we're looking, and I had the opportunity to work with Jody and GSK and other colleagues in Washington on putting some of these metrics together as well. Briefly, we've got to figure out what we want to measure in order to measure it so we can quantify it and figure out how, well, it's such a simple idea, but it's not, as to how we're moving forward or how we're not. There are a number of different measurements that are out there. Most are designed around the national quality NQCA.
National Center for Quality Assurance.
Thank you. Thank you. And they deal with everything ranging from smoking cessation to childhood adult immunization rates, medication adherence, and specifically HIV viral load suppression in a community, which is one of the newer ones that was put in place under the Affordable Care Act. I've included some documentation, including the current 2015 NCQA requirements, and I'm happy to answer any questions now or at any time. Thank you.
Thank you, BJ.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jesse O'Brien. I'm the healthcare advocate with OSPIRG, which is the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group. OSPIRG also strongly supports Senate Bill 440, and I won't belabor the case for the bill, which I think has been made eloquently by the people before me. I'll just say I think this is a common sense proposal. It's a way of creating alignment that's sorely needed and reducing duplication of effort. One thing that I would like to mention is that I included this in my written remarks. One key player that's not as clearly outlined in the bill as we would prefer is the Department of Consumer and Business Services, DCBS. And traditionally, they have not been very involved in health plan quality measurement, but that is starting to change. And so we would advocate for including them in the bill. I have run this by them, and I shouldn't speak for them, but they seem
I'm
okay
getting
with
nods.
The idea.
No.
the reason this is important is twofold. For one piece, the insurance division of DCBS has recently, for the first time last year, started including health plan quality measures in the requirements for health insurance rate filings. We think that's an important transparency measure and a way that the rate review process could start creating incentives for insurance companies to transform the healthcare delivery system. And we would like to see those measures aligned with other efforts of the health authority, PEB and OEB, and so forth. And then secondly, with the passage of Senate Bill 1, DCBS has assumed authority over Oregon's state-based health insurance exchange. And it would be an understatement to say that it's not entirely clear what the role of the exchange is going to be in quality measurement or a number of other things. But quality measurement is one of the roles of a state-based health insurance exchange, and we would like to see them at the table so that they could be part of the conversation about a statewide strategy in that area going forward. Thank you.
Question, comments?
No, I just need to have that conversation with Mr. O'Brien and understand that a little better.
For those who are back there nodding on all this stuff, let's keep the exchange over there, okay?
Thank you.
Well, just to clarify, if I might, then, Madam Chair, Mr. O'Brien, you're just saying that we need to be thinking about these kinds of things as we think about quality scores for insurance companies and about how we set rates and all that kind of stuff, too, to make sure that people are using the right, that insurance companies are using metrics that actually matter to patients. Am I understanding you correctly? Ms. Higgins, you looks like you have something to add.
Of course. Yeah.
I'm going to preempt your authority, Madam Chair.
Chair, Senator Hayward. The role of these metrics in the rate review process so far has been mostly a matter of increasing transparency about what health insurance companies are doing to improve the quality of care for their patients. And their intent all along was to try to align the measures that they were looking at with a broader statewide strategy around transforming the healthcare delivery system. But in order for that to move forward in the way that I think we would all want it to, I think they should be at the table.
Chairman Sanderson, for the record, this is Felisa Higgins with SEIU again. So in your Dash 1 amendments, we actually, our intention was to include the Department of Consumer and Business Services for the two reasons that Jesse outlined. One is that when the exchange was created, you are seeing quality scores on the exchange as well as cost. So the exchange also has quality measurements that may or may not align with the rest of the measurements, but do take into account claims-based and some clinical data that is needed to measure them to come up with that quality score. So this is part of our issue, as outlined before, that you have other sort of one-offs creating healthcare-related measurements that providers are supposed to submit to somebody somewhere. So our hope is actually...
People wonder why doctors burn out quickly.
Yes. So in the Dash 1s, we actually do include the Department of Consumer and Business Services as part of the committee, as well as taking into account the exchange metrics and the rate review metrics, which also may be. And then there are a couple of other groups also creating healthcare metrics that we we're hoping to bring in underneath this committee.
Madam Chair, if I may. Thank you. I would then add, if I could, two other things for you all to consider as you're working on banging this through this. Thing number one, not only does NCQA talk about health outcome metrics, they have standards for primary care homes, which are different from Oregon's standard for primary care homes. And some insurance companies will acknowledge Oregon standards and some will only acknowledge NCQA standards. And it depends on, generally speaking, whether they actually have a big presence in this state or not. Mm-hmm. I do think that the more that we can standardize things and have high quality metrics, because I think most people in the country who care about patient-centered primary care homes think that Oregon standards are some of the best in the world, not just in the nation, but some of the best in the world. And why practices should have to do a whole other set of paperwork to meet standards that are less good is a little beyond my comprehension. The second piece of it is, and I think I will say this very publicly, I think insurance companies in Oregon do a really good job of primarily focusing on Oregon standards, but we do have some players in the market. The second thing is, we should then perhaps consider, if we're bringing DCBS into this conversation, as whether we want eventually to include information on the exchange about how insurance companies are thinking about alternative reimbursement methods, because fee-for-service, I think we pretty much all agree that fee-for-service is hopefully going the way of the dodo bird. How fast? That's a little bit unclear. But it's not a model that's working well for long-term healthcare provision, healthcare savings, et cetera, doesn't help us meet the triple aim. So whether that's too ambitious, I don't know, but I'd just like to put that in your thinker to add to your conversation, because we really should be thinking about this broadly construed. It's part of also patient engagement and having people start to take more responsibility for their own healthcare and helping control healthcare costs. And I think we all agree that until consumers can be well educated about what healthcare costs, really costs, and what, you know, how physicians and other healthcare providers are being paid, we're not gonna solve that part of the patient responsibility piece. There are two kinds of patient responsibility, and one of them is helping can control costs directly. The other is actually engaging in your own well-being. But that part's just as important, the financial part's just as important. So if you guys would consider that as well. If you say it's too much, that's cool.
If I may briefly, Chair, Senator Hayward, I completely agree with you. I think we share that vision. I wanted to clarify one thing about the role of the health insurance exchange in quality metrics. Under the Cover Oregon exchange, they developed their own set of quality measures. Now that our state-based exchange is using the federal technology, there's currently no quality measures posted through the portal. There is a federal set of quality measures that I anticipate we're going to be using for next year's open enrollment period. There may, even if we continue using the federal technology, however, there may be flexibility in future years for states to have some input into what quality measures are displayed using the federal portal, and that's part of why I think it's important for the exchange to be a part of this conversation.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah,
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. While I agree with the points Senator Steiner Hayward was making, I think phase one is to have a system that the providers understand. I think this will be a multi-phase process, but the phase one is to have something that the people who actually operate the system can understand and know what they're supposed to be measuring. So, but I would suggest, although that's an ambitious proposal, that we take care of the basics first. That would be my suggestion.
You know me, Senator. I'm always ambitious.
I know you are.
Now,
if I may, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, in addition to having something that providers understand, for us it's very important that we have something that patients can understand as well, and it not only understand but be able to use and to make the best informed choices as to how to spend their healthcare dollar.
And I would suggest for a lot of the patients, having their provider be able to explain it to them is how they will understand it. So
definitely.
guy.
So I want you all to know that, you know, once you've had a public hearing, we're going to try to just have work sessions. But it doesn't mean that we won't be calling you up to explain amendments, see if there's consensus, et cetera, because we're sort of running out of time, and we still have a number of bills that we haven't heard and that hopefully will pass. So just as a word. Okay.
You know where to find us.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 440 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 520. Zena.
Senate Bill 520 modifies the age for which a pharmacist may administer vaccines from 11 years old to 7 years old. There's no amendment and no revenue impacts, and there's a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. And we have Liz, is it Houchin? And Amy Valdez, and I'd like the Board of Pharmacy to come up because we have questions. I have questions for you.
Senator Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lise Houchin. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the National Association of Chain Drugstores. And on behalf of the member of the National Association of Chain Drugstores, I'd like to thank you very much for having a hearing today on Senate Bill 520. I'd also like to personally thank Senator Cruz for sponsoring the legislation that would lower the age of pharmacists being able to give immunizations down to age 7. In 2012, only 1.7% of Oregon residents were immunized for influenza, ranking 45th in the country. Pharmacists received training and a certificate in the prescribing and administering of all the immunizations approved by the CDC down to the age of 3 through a CDC-approved training program that is provided through American Pharmacists Association. Pharmacy students also have immunization training and receive a certificate as part of their curriculum. As part of their education, all of these pharmacists are trained to deal with any potential adverse reactions. In calendar year 2014, over 135,000 immunizations were provided in community pharmacies in the state of Oregon. We are encouraged by Senate Bill 520 that many additional needed vaccines will be administered in local communities by pharmacists to patients and families that might otherwise go unimmunized. We believe by lowering the age, more families will take advantage of immunizations at their local pharmacies. We thank you very much for hearing this bill today and urge your swift action on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amy Valdez. I'm a licensed pharmacist in the state of Oregon. I practice as the chief clinical lead coordinator trainer for Albertson Safeway Pharmacies. Today, I'm here representing the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists to urge your support of Senate Bill 520 to lower the patient age to 7 for pharmacists to administer vaccines. Our services have been expanding. Now it is common practice for pharmacist services to cover year-round vaccines across the lifespan. And although pharmacists are now allowed to immunize in all 50 states, there are still some state-level limitations which affect how we practice, one of them being restrictions on the age of the patient. Currently, pharmacists in 22 states may administer vaccines to patients of any age. The remaining states do have restrictions for age, which range from as young as 5 years of age in North Dakota to 19 years of age in Wyoming. All in all, 33 states allow pharmacists to vaccinate under the age of 11, the current age in Oregon. I'd like to point out a couple points for you to consider in expanding pharmacist-administered vaccines. As was mentioned, immunization rates in Oregon are not where we would like them to be. We consider this an urgent public health issue, especially in light of recent disease outbreaks. When you consider incidents like the measles outbreak in Disneyland, there is data that's directly linked to vaccination rates in our communities and in our states. Nationwide, pharmacists have been immunizing for the last 20 years or so. We have hundreds of thousands of pharmacists trained across the country to immunize. And because of that, the pharmacy is becoming a more frequent destination. More than 20% of patients that get vaccinated now are seeking those vaccines in community pharmacies. And recent research has shown that there is support for pharmacists vaccinating children, and that when pharmacists are involved, that vaccination rates rise.
The Gold Standard Training Program, I am a faculty instructor for that program, and I can assure you does cover across the program content related to vaccinating children and assessing the vaccine needs across the lifespan. This program is designed to be used nationwide across multiple states with varying laws, and therefore does cover the entire lifespan. As a side note, the Board of Pharmacy does approve training programs for immunizing pharmacists. And so there is a mechanism available to assess if training programs are adequate. Pharmacists are only trained to vaccinate intramuscularly in the deltoid. Changing the age from 11 to 7 would not change the physical location of where we vaccinate the patient. This is set out by guidelines that are issued by the Oregon Health Authority, so we would still be bound by those protocols, the actual physical site of where we vaccinate the patient. Subcutaneous and nasal administration also would not change by changing the age from 11 to 7. That technique would be exactly the same as it is today for an older patient that we already vaccinate. I'd also like to point out that pharmacists currently in Oregon are required to report vaccines to the Alert IIS, which is a state registry for immunizations. We are also required to consult Alert IIS before we vaccinate. So it's a perfect opportunity for the pharmacist to assess what each patient's needs and what they might be lacking in their vaccine status. Just looking at the data of what's kind of occurring now, and looking at this last flu season, pharmacists in the state of Oregon by prescription actually administered over 1,000 flu shots to patients under the age of 11. So this practice is currently happening in Oregon by prescription. Unfortunately, in some of our border cities, being Portland being the largest one, sometimes Oregon children are being referred out of state for vaccination when a pharmacy cannot vaccinate. Lowering the age from 11 to 7 would allow that vaccination to happen in the state and therefore get reported to Alert, which would be a positive effect on the data set and the usefulness of Alert IIS. Also, changing from 11 to 7 would not be a difference in the schedule that we use. Because we currently vaccinate down to age 11, we are very familiar with using the adolescent or what they call the preteen schedule. It's divided into three categories. Currently, we are using two-thirds of that page, so it would be simply adding in that extra third for the 7 to 10 age range. And that is a natural break in the CDC schedule. If you look at the schedule of vaccinations for children, there is a natural break between ages 4 and 6 where you're still giving routine doses as part of a series, and then that changing over at age 7 to really where we kind of leap into the catch-up immunization schedule. So there is a natural break there, which is a very natural place for pharmacists to be able to vaccinate down to. As was mentioned, we are already equipped to deal with adverse reactions. When the age changed to age 11, we were required to have pediatric equipment in our e-kits. And because our pharmacists are vaccinating these lower ages by prescription, many of our pharmacies in the state already have the required epinephrine doses and emergency equipment to deal with children. So it would just be a simple change in requiring that equipment versus recommending that equipment because of the lower age.
And that would be done by rule?
I would assume the Board of Pharmacy would do that by rule.
Yes.
So in summary, we don't view this as a substantial change in practice. It's something that pharmacists are already participating in within the state, and we think this would positively affect immunization rates in the state of Oregon by providing additional access to patients. We urge your adoption of Senate Bill 520. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Well, and you may be able to answer them, but I wanted the board to be here just because, first of all, do you have a stance on this?
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, my name is Marcus Watt. I'm the executive director of the Board of Pharmacy. Our board has no position on this. We're neutral.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to make sure that if there would be any more training, it doesn't sound like there would need to be much more training for those under the age of 11.
I don't believe so.
And then, and that goes the same for bad reactions? Excuse me. Yes.
Correct. So just the information for dosing by weight, we would simply be adding on some additional recommendations for the weight ranges for ages 7 to 11.
And do you have in your rules, thank you, do you have in your rules regarding storage, I mean, so that your pharmacists know how to store?
We do, as we do for all our drugs, and we are currently rewriting those rules to become more stringent going forward. That should be completed in the next 6 months.
Okay. And again, I wanted to reiterate, you say all of this will be on the deltoid.
Correct.
Yes. Do you have to have special malpractice insurance for this?
No, I believe it's currently covered by their current malpractice. And again, these are all being done under protocol by the Oregon Health Authority, so it's very strict and it dictates how this will occur.
So you do have written informed consent?
Yes.
Okay. And you're able to bill for reimbursement, correct?
Absolutely. So there is, it would be the same practice that we do today for privately insured patients. There are currently no VFC pharmacies in Oregon, so there is a gap for VFC covered children, which exists right now. Any child that is Medicaid eligible under the age of 18 cannot be vaccinated at pharmacy unless they are a VFC provider.
Okay.
And the state is looking at that process, so that would not be a change, but that is a population that is excluded now for billing for that reason.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question about that? So is that a choice by the pharmacist? They don't want to participate in VFC?
There is some differences in the rules and regulations, so molding those to make them friendly to pharmacies. So there are some equipment requirements, and there are applications that have to be made. It is possible, and the state is actively looking at getting pharmacies involved in that process.
Yeah. I mean, I think they'll be happy to take you. I think I'd like to see the initiative being on the pharmacist to say, look, we see as part of our mission that we need to not just deal with privately insured patients, but we have an obligation to take on the Medicaid patients as well.
Yeah, and a lot of it comes down to the inventory requirements. So there has to be a separation of the public and the private vaccine. So it's just working through that with the state to make sure everybody's happy, how things are mixed, supplies are mixed.
That is a good point.
Well, I think you've underlined one of the challenges for primary care. It's a real pain in the tail.
Mm-hmm.
And but if, you know, primary care providers are going to do it, yes.
So, and the reason I'm asking these questions, because the dental board had some real issues with a bill that we took off the agenda, 675, I think it's 675, yeah. So for the billing, do you have to have special training and ability to be able to bill, or you're just in that process of billing? I think that's the difference between, I don't know.
Madam Chair, that wouldn't make any difference whether the immunization was given to a 70-year-old or an 80-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, for community pharmacies, vaccines are pretty much billed the same way as prescriptions. So it would be just like filling. Any pharmacy that can bill for a prescription can bill for a vaccine as
well. I believe that might be part of the challenge, is that the medical side bills on a different system than the pharmacy side does. So if it doesn't allow access, then that's a barrier.
Okay. So regarding the immunization registry, there's a training then that you had, the pharmacist had to go through, and it was
absolutely so
in rule for the board set up.
Yes, and our investigators inspect every pharmacy every year. One of the things they look for is they question the pharmacist on staff and challenge them to access the system to show them where they're at, so that we know for a fact that they are and they're capable of accessing it.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator Shields and then Senator Cruz.
And so what I heard you saying in your testimony is that right now every pharmacist is putting in or are required to put in every vaccine that they give into the database.
That's correct, of all ages.
And outside of that, is there any other interaction that you have with a primary care provider after you give a vaccine?
There is not. In 2011, when the age changed to 11, the requirement to contact the primary care provider went away in lieu of the requirement to report to Alert. so that there would be a central registry that all providers across the state would access versus taking the patient's word at who their current primary care provider was and manually distributing that information.
Could I ask one last question,
yes.
Madam Chair? So let's say you have, this is a real life scenario, in our district, which is highly unimmunized, mm-hmm. you have a mother come in and she says, you know, I'm thinking about this alternative schedule. What do you think? How do the pharmacists deal with that?
So part of our training specifically deals with what we call the patient care interaction. And part of that is advocating and educating patients about the immunization schedules. There's also an extensive module that covers myths and perceptions around vaccines. So I think pharmacists are very highly trained to deal with issues surrounding why people don't get vaccinated. Specifically, the American Pharmacy Association training uses a motivational interviewing technique to help tease out from the patient, you know, what those barriers might be and helping to address them. So I think the pharmacists are educated to address those questions. Specifically, we are bound by the protocols from Oregon Health Authority, so we can only vaccinate within those guidelines. So if alternative schedules are not published within those Oregon Health Authority protocols, pharmacists are not allowed to use them, unless by prescription.
Hey, Senator Cruz and then Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Sure, sorry.
I just want to point out, all this bill does is change the age. It doesn't change anything else. All it does is change the age.
Did you have another
comment? Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Well, I just want to say two things. First of all, you know, in a primary care practice, it's generally standard of care when a kid's coming in to look at the immunization alert system, not just at your own electronic health record to make sure. And the nice thing is now that there's synchronization between most of the electronic health record systems and immunization alerts, so there's a two-way feed, which is really great. It helps update them. But I'm really interested in what you say about the training about motivational interviewing, and I'm very curious to know if there's any better uptake of immunizations when pharmacists counsel patients about immunizations as opposed to when physicians or NPs or PAs counsel them. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I don't have any pride of ownership for physicians, and I don't think Senator Shields' wife has any pride of ownership for NPs. Whoever can get kids immunized, that's a good thing. So do you have data that show the efficacy? Because the latest data on physicians counseling show that no matter what you do, it doesn't seem to help.
I agree. It is a very challenging situation. I have not seen data that specifically speaks to pharmacist success rate versus other providers. I think it becomes more of a sheer number thing. And if you're hearing the same message from all of your providers, that hopefully that resonates with the patient. I think what we do look to is that patients do visit their pharmacy probably more frequently than they do most other providers. So it's a repeatable message. Pharmacists are seen as, you know, a place where people can go to get free advice. I think that's what many of our community members see us as. And so I think leveraging that relationship that we have with our patients to start that conversation absolutely is something that we do. Is there universal success? Just like many of the providers experience frustration, you know, we have the same frustrations with patients for sure.
Really quick follow-up. Do you guys do any I sincerely doubt you do, but you guys don't check and see, like if you're filling a prescription for a child, you don't proactively check immunization alert to see if the kid's up to date on immunizations, do you?
So it depends on the practice site. There are certainly community pharmacy sites where there is IT integration that can happen, not at every practice site because of IT limitations, but that is definitely possible, and that is something that is happening in the practice. And as we transition towards more of a global electronic health record and pharmacies are integrated into that, that certainly is something that is possible. Would I say that it's happening universally in Oregon today? Probably not.
But we are on that pathway, and that is happening among some systems, definitely.
I'd like to have a longer conversation with you about that than we can have here. So if you wouldn't mind scheduling something with my office or whoever's the right person to do that, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
All right. Okay. We do have the fiscal and revenue, so I'll close the public hearing. Thank you very much. Public hearing on Senate Bill 520 and open a work session on Senate Bill 520.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 520 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Madam Chair, a lot of my questions were answered, but I you know, I think that there is a difference between an 11-year-old and a 7-year-old. So while I think this is more that just a signal that I'd like to send to the rest of the House that, you know, there may be some more study that needs to happen here. But so I think I'll be voting no, but it doesn't, it's not a strong no. It's more of a I'd like to learn more no.
Senator Cruz.
I'm sorry. I would point out that the difference between 11 and 7 is a different part of the schedule. So the schedule is designed for them. So it's not like we're putting something that a 13-year-old would have into a 7-year-old. It's a schedule that's designed for them. So it's already been vetted in a much more scientific set of circumstances than we have here, and I have absolute faith that it's the right protocols.
Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Shields?
Nope.
Senator Stern Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Pope?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Moore? Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Cruz it's his bill, and he will carry the bill, and I close the work session on Senate Bill 520, and have we accomplished our tasks for the day?
Busy day.
We are adjourned. Accomplished our tasks for the day?
Busy day.
We are adjourned. Accomplished